You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the podcast network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. Welcome to episode 21 of the Wells Tech Podcast for Wednesday, May 28, 2008. I'm Martin Spriggs, your host for this weekly conversation about technology and how it might assist you in your ministry. And today I have two lovely co-hosts. Direct from Sleepy Eye, Minnesota, is Sally Draper. Good morning, Sally.
Hi, everybody.
And our semi-regular classroom technology correspondent from New London, Wisconsin, Gail Potratz. Good morning, Gail.
Good morning, everyone.
How do you like that title I just whipped up?
I thought that was pretty impressive, Martin.
Semi-regular classroom technology correspondent. Won't fit on your business card, but
No. We
can use it here on the podcast. Well, we're really actually very happy that Gail has consented to join us each month. We know we have a lot of listeners who are teachers, and this show, in fact, this show, we're going to focus on how to teach digital learners of the 21st century. Let's talk about digital learners. So maybe on the more philosophical side, what do we mean when we say digital learners of the 21st century?
Well, that term, digital natives, actually was coined by Mark Prensky in 2001, mm-hmm. when he started identifying this group of people that are right now in kindergarten through college. And he called them digital natives because they're the first group of people that have gone through their life surrounded by all of the technology tools and the products that the rest of us that are older than that age group have not grown up with. Mm-hmm. And that makes a big difference in how these people think and learn and live their lives. So, and who are they? They're the kids sitting right in front of us in our Lutheran schools this morning, just probably finished a nice Word of God lesson and are on to their daily subjects. That's, mm-hmm. that's who they are.
So what age group are we talking about here?
Well, I'm going to say definitely the 20-somethings.
Okay.
And the reason I know that is because when I work with people who are younger teachers in the 20-somethings, a lot of this stuff is intuitive to them. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily read the manual first because they know the program will explain itself, and they, you know, they're just more intuitive in how they handle technology. Kids that have gone through kindergarten through college, like I said, and now are in the 20 age group, I'd say, are mm-hmm. the people we're talking about. But the kids right in front of us are definitely digital natives.
Mm-hmm. Most of them are walking around with iPods in their pockets and headphones in their ears, essentially making use of that technology every waking hour for the most part.
Correct. I read a statistic the other day from a National School Board Association that said that all kids, call them tweens, between eight through 12-year-olds, 96% of that age group, if they have access to the internet, are involved in some kind of social networking.
Mm, right.
96%.
So are social networks kind of a characteristic of this digital native? People want to connect with each other online in a virtual way?
Right. Digital natives are hyper-connectors. Mm-hmm. They're connected in many, many different ways. They use not probably just one social networking tool, but, you know, they're text messaging, they're Facebooking, they're Twittering, they're using their cell phones. I don't know if any of them use email anymore. That's kind of like snail mail to them, I think.
That's old school.
That's right.
I'm even thinking about the way the kids can connect through their video games, through the Wii and the characters they can share online and the internet access that's possible there. So it's kind of seamless for them. It's just what they do.
Yes.
So they're kind of wired up a little bit differently, so to speak. I know in looking at my kids who are just on the edge of that, my youngest is just graduating from eighth grade this year. They are able to multitask like I couldn't even imagine. You know, they're listening to music, they're chatting on their computer, they're maybe working on an email, they're supposedly doing their homework all at the same time. Is that a different, you know, way that these kids are wired up, that they're able to do that, or, you know, are they essentially the same as we were?
Well, I had a hard time with that when I first started reading about this subject because, you know, being from the old school myself and being a teacher, you didn't really ever teach kids to multitask in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not. You know, don't turn that radio on when you're doing your homework.
Right.
You know? So, but yeah, it's true. They do that. They're multitaskers. They work much faster. You know, they work at twitch speed, they say, always working fast. And also, they're non-linear learners. You know, they're grabbing from all over, not just like in school, usually this the process, first this, then this, but they're not very non-linear. Mm-hmm. And yes, they are different. Research says the old beliefs were that when you got to be 3 years old, your brain matter pretty much stopped shaping itself.
Mm-hmm.
But now they've got this new science they call neuroplasticity of the brain, and they've actually done studies on this, and what has determined the brains have actually changed in these kids in this generation, and because of the stimuli they've grown up with. And they've done a lot of really interesting experiments where they've taken animals and switched brain sensory, like the eyes and the ears, switched them around, like in the brain. I don't know how they did this, but mm-hmm. then stimulated them, and their brains changed to accommodate for those different stimulations coming at them from different ways than they were used to before.
Amazing.
So it is really amazing research when you start reading it, and you don't want to say, like, the term is rewired the brain. That to me sounds a little like Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, yes, the brains in these people, because of the stimulation they've received, they're different than ours.
This makes you appreciate how God has wired us up and put this body together, how we have this elastic, you know, nature to us that we can you know, move in different directions depending on external stimulus and our environments, and those kinds of things all work together. So how does this all come together for the teacher? What difference does it make to the teacher? I would assume there's a huge impact on the teaching community about how you essentially educate this new, you know, digital native generation.
Well, I can definitely see that in where I live. I don't know, Sally, how about you? Do you notice that in the classroom out there in Sleepy Eye too?
Sure, absolutely. The kids are, I guess the expectations are higher, whether it's stated or not. They are, they're needing to be fed in a lot of different levels.
Mm-hmm.
And including technology in your curriculum is one incredible way to make contact with these digital natives. Educators need to step up and learn new technology. Maybe they start small or whatever, but they need to begin to bridge that gap, shifting the tools and the methods that we're using to teach to include technology seamlessly in that education process.
Yeah, that word seamless is, I think, important here. As I think about digital immigrants, they approach technology probably in a totally different way. You know, they think of it as the computer lab. You know, we're going to learn technology, and it's really not about that for the digital natives. It's how they can integrate, or how they should integrate technology into the learning experience. It's not, you know, a time of day that you deal with technology. And I suppose the digital immigrants that we have that are potentially struggling with this in the classroom really are maybe making some mistakes there and need to, you know, take a step back and say, how is technology going to help what I do as a teacher?
And you think of those kids who are constantly getting the stimulus from all these other social connections and their technology pieces that they're using for information and processing all the time. And then you walk in the school door and you turn off your cell phone, you park your iPod at the door, in many areas, and then you come in and now you sit down and now you're going to learn. Mm-hmm. So there's really a huge disconnect, and some people feel that kids have a more information-rich environment outside the classroom than they do inside.
Right.
Now, before we go too far with the technology, though, I do think it's important that when you talk about teaching, this is a real scary subject for teachers because it's very overwhelming to think of changing your approach and your tools and everything. But actually, I really think that basic pedagogy is still really something that teachers that were good teachers without technology will be good teachers with technologies. Mm-hmm. There's just some solid teaching that goes along with this that you're not going to change. And part of that solid teaching is learning how to construct lessons. Now, lessons may be changing. We're approaching more project-based learning, inquiry-based learning, project-based, problem-based, and inquiry. They can all be kind of interchanged. Mm-hmm. There are differences. But,
right.
I think teachers probably need some solid, if they're not already doing that, they really, first of all, need some solid instruction in how to use those kind of lessons in a classroom, whether there's technology connected to them or not. Mm-hmm. Because those are the kind of lessons that you're going to be able to introduce technology and use it seamlessly in.
Right.
Rather than this forced connection that you were talking about, Martin.
Sure, yeah. Before we kind of talk about some of the tools that are at the disposal now of teachers, one thing that struck me in thinking about the classroom environment today is one of the priorities for any teacher, at least in my educational experience, was they were trying to teach me how to learn. You know, what tools to use, how to use the library, how to use the card catalog, how to verify sources, how to document your sources, those kinds of things. It's a whole different ball game now with the internet. Teachers need to understand that there are tools at a student's disposal that never existed for them, namely this thing called the internet, and how to use, you know, I think essentially they need to use to teach the students how to use the tools of the internet, how to investigate sources, because the internet is in some senses the wild, wild west. You know, we talk about Wikipedia, you know, great resource, but not the, you know, not your mother's, you know, encyclopedia, you know, where there have been researchers who have spent hours and hours and days and years, you know, verifying these resources. So you could count on the encyclopedia being accurate. Not always the case with Wikipedia or any other online research. So how to search smart, how to find resources, all of those things are in play right now, aren't they?
I agree, Martin, most definitely. And one of the things that we try to do over the course of the school year with our computer lab time is just educate kids about reliable sources and teach them how to search so that when they do face different challenges that they're trying to research or whatever for school projects, they have the tools at their disposal and they can be wise and discerning users of those tools. So we do things like internet fact races where I just throw up some questions up on the board and a mind map, and the kids race through the resources that are approved for them to use in our computer lab and try to find answers to things. Mm-hmm. And just kind of cluing them in little by little. We add resources over the school year to different ways that they can find information that's at their fingertips.
Mm-hmm. So that's great, Sally. What you're really doing is providing them with skills. There are skills that need to be taught and even could be measured if you had a curriculum, talking educationally, and searching would be one of those kinds of skills. Mm-hmm. And the idea is because then you're equipped so that you can do the project-based learning. If you don't know how to search, project-based learning becomes much more difficult. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. there's two things here. I read a very interesting article just this morning, in fact, and it was talking about searching. The NetTrekker people who do a child-safe internet search engine, took 20,000 schools worldwide, and they just got together a survey here on the top searches that kids made in schools over the last year. It's just...
Well, that would be interesting.
The number one search that kids did, games.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. See, digital natives are much more fun-oriented than work-oriented, you know? And dogs was two. Animals, Civil War, George Washington. Those were the top five.
Okay.
Now, if you look at that, the point is, I think, Sally, not everybody out there is really doing the job that you're doing there in Sleepy Eye and teaching kids how to search, because they would be searching for much different things than those top fives. You know, not that it wouldn't be good to search for the Civil War, but the fact that those are repeated that often, to me, there's a message there. Mm-hmm. Teachers need to force themselves to become more digital learners and get more involved in this project-based learning and teaching kids how to use the tools that really the kids already are using for other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before the show, you know, kind of in our pre-show conversation, Gail, you were talking about another article you were reading by David Warlick called 2 Cents Worth, one of his blogs, right? You want to share that with our listeners, what he was talking about with digital natives and, you know, what kind of generation we're raising here?
Right. The whole problem in education right now is, or one issue, is the fact that we have in our desks in front of us digital natives, and the people teaching them for the greatest part are digital immigrants. Okay, and we always have one foot in the old culture that we came out of. For example, people that call you on the phone and say, "Did you get my email?"
Right.
A student would never think of that, a digital learner.
Right.
Or call you over to the computer to look at the website instead of emailing you the URL.
Right.
You know, we don't think the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, his point is, okay, that's our problem. We've got the two kind of juxtaposed with each other here, that the leaders that are supposed to lead the kids aren't equipped with the same brains, actually, as the kids in front of them. And that becomes a problem. So the teachers and the young adults are kind of drowning in this tidal wave of all this youth and stuff delivered through all these digital tools. And amidst that comes at them the adult realities of, like, the Civil War and foreign affairs and politics and fine arts. And those things just can't break through and be communicated to them, the way we're doing it now, and be effective. The kids can't appreciate that. So basically what's going to have to happen is the kids already have learned the tools, and the adults, the teachers, realize what the rich content that they have that they want to communicate to the kids. So we're going to have to learn how to communicate and create lessons and projects that use those tools.
Right.
Because then they will become engaged in learning, because they're already using them. The article talked about kids basically have multimedia centers set up in their bedrooms. That's true. Think about it.
Right.
And so they're not probably doing much with the Civil War there on those tools in their bedroom. But right. If we have those tools in the classroom and we have created project-based learning around those tools with the content that we want the kids to be exposed to, That's the magic solution. Then you're going to have engaged learners, and then you're not going to have what this author refers to as the dumbest generation, because he's claiming that our generation right now is actually the dumbest generation, because they've got the use of these powerful tools on the internet, but they're using not the rich content of it, but all the social and other things,
right.
And they're losing ground.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to meld the two.
I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of a teacher who's listening to this podcast. They're just shaking their head, saying, "How do we bridge this gap? It's like jumping the Grand Canyon." So maybe that's a good segue into some tools. It's not all bad news, because I think there are tools, and educators have these at their disposal, and some of them are very affordable or even free to use. Maybe we can talk a little bit about what tools are available to educators these days.
Well, it's kind of a wide open spectrum there, Martin. And I guess what I would say is to start with one thing, to start small and build on it and grow your knowledge as you learn the various tools you want to experiment with. One that I like to recommend to educators, maybe at an upper grade level in our Lutheran elementary schools, would be to use the CNN student news resources that are available on the CNN website. They have a whole website you can tune in each day to news geared to students maybe grade six and up, and all the teacher related resources around the daily news. So your current events doesn't have to be, go and research and find articles about something. It is watch the current news and discuss it and explore it further and things. So just bringing in that that video resource into your classroom is one way to get started, and allow the students to, you know, be a little bit more engaged with your current event lessons. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very overwhelming to look at it all. Starting small is a good idea. excuse me. One of the tools also is Google Earth, and I know you've talked about it before on the show here. But that is a fantastic tool for, obviously, social studies would be the one you'd think of first, maybe, but it can be used for so many things. I saw a lesson... I'll call him a digital native because he's a teacher at our school who has just been out teaching for 2 years. So he is pretty intuitive about these things, and he has grabbed onto Google Earth and can do a lot with it very quickly. See, I use it, but I'm slow. Mm-hmm. He just does it and picks it up and goes very fast. And he taught a Bible history lesson on the desert. The children of Israel in the desert, you know, and took them right out there to the desert and showed up what it was like and the path they followed and the Red Sea, and pretty cool. And that really, I mean, that they're interested in that tool. That's neat technology for them. And it takes a little bit to learn that tool. Mm-hmm. And that isn't connected to a whole big lesson. It's just kind of a supplement. If you start supplementing your lessons with these things, you don't have to build a full-blown, huge, week-long, project-based learning right away. Mm-hmm. You start supplementing a little bit with these tools as you go.
Right. Maybe as we continue to have Gail back each month, the last Wednesday of the month, we can focus in on a few more of these tools and how specific teachers are using some of them in classroom environments to create curriculum. And there's all kinds of tools that are coming out now that, one of the reasons that I love this show and love to do it is we try and provide shortcuts, kind of weed through all the noise and the clutter of the internet and help our listeners find things that are going to be useful right away, and to give them practical examples is a great way to do that. So check out the show notes. We'll have a few more links in there, and check back in a couple weeks when we have Gail back on again. We can talk more about this concept of digital learners and all the tools that are at our disposal now. And maybe we should remind our listeners that this is not just for the elementary school teacher per se, although a lot of those that would be interested in this are, in that class. But I think even pastors teaching confirmation class, you're still teaching digital learners, and you have to figure out how to teach an age-old topic. Obviously, confirmation is focused around the catechism, how to enliven that to a point where your students are actually doing some learning, and it's not just an exercise for them. It becomes a part of how they learn. So maybe we can talk a little bit more about that as well. Up next, our picks of the week. Gail, you want to start us off this week? Do you have a pick or tip of the week?
Well, it was a hard time for me to pick one, but I picked a product or a software program called Ecamm.
Uh-huh.
And Ecamm is a add-on to Skype. So, and this Ecamm is just for the Mac.
Okay.
But I checked out another one, and it's on the show notes. I don't remember. Power something.
Power Grammo, I think, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Power Grammo. And I did download that on the PC and use it as well, so sure. I can vouch for both of them.
So what does Ecamm do?
They record your conversation and your video, if you have video, while you're doing Skype. And then it just very easily, real easy interface, one button, record, makes it into a little file on your desktop when you're done. You can pop it into a podcast, send it through email, whatever you want to do with it. Mm-hmm. Just real handy, can be used in a lot of ways.
And how have you used it?
To have students interview somebody on Skype that, you know, isn't in the room.
Okay.
They can talk on Skype and record it, and then we can put it into a podcast.
Okay, so that's Ecamm. Is there a cost for it?
You can use it for free for a while, but then you'll have to cough up $14.95, which to me is well worth it.
Okay, great.
Almost free.
All right, almost free, yes.
Yeah.
Ecamm. Sally, what's up for you?
Well, guys, true confessions here. I've got vacation on my mind. It's summertime, and I'm ready to hit the road with a little camping trip with my family out to the Mount Rushmore area. And while we're camping, we're going to be doing some geocaching, and I thought that would be a neat pick to share with our listeners today, because there are educational implications to geocaching as well. Geocaching is basically a worldwide treasure hunt, and you can find out more information at geocaching.com. And what it is people hide typically Tupperware containers in the woods somewhere, and they post the coordinates, latitude and longitudinal coordinates, on this website, geocaching.com, and those can be downloaded to a global positioning system, a receiver that's portable that you can take with you to go out on your treasure hunt. And basically the arrow points you the way to where the item is hidden. And so it's a really interesting activity to do with a group of people, say your youth group or students in your school. There's a lot of learning that can go on around it, where you're talking about mapping and latitude and longitude, how to use the internet to download the coordinates. And also, many of the geocaches have puzzles built around them. One that's real interesting that we just found here in the Sleepy Eye area is put on by the Minnesota State Parks System, and it was just announced last week on Mother's Day, or I guess that was 2 weeks ago now. And what they did was they hit a geocache in each state park in the whole park system. I think there's 72 of them. Mm-hmm. And it's really meant to educate you about the state park system, because in each one there's kind of a history card, a collector trading card that you can get when you go and find these different geocaches in the different state parks. And it has the park history and things like that. So just a really fun activity, and definitely an education side to it. Another link that I'm going to put in the show notes is to a site called educaching.com, and this is a teacher that's put together a complete curriculum around geocaching. So you can download his curriculum, and he was actually interviewed on another podcast recently and explained all about his educaching website. So lots and lots of ramifications around this, and ripple effects that you can make use of in your classroom or with your maybe your church youth group or something. A really fun activity, and one that I highly recommend as a great family activity as well. We've found, I think we're up to 167 caches in 14 different states. We've seen some awesome sites just because geocaching took us to some really neat places. So I encourage you to check it out at geocaching.com.
Sally, you're going to have to give us a report on what you found on your vacation.
There you go.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It is fun.
My pick is a tool that helps anybody who ever has had trouble emailing large attachments. Many email systems, in fact, almost all email systems, have a limit on the size of an attachment. We here in the Senate office limit that to, I believe it's 7 megs of an attachment. And email is probably not the best transport system for large files. So what do? You need to have a website where you can upload them to, and or an FTP site where you can upload them to. Then you need to give the other person permissions to that. It's just a nightmare for transferring large files around. As we begin to to move larger and larger files around, audio and video files, large PowerPoints, those kinds of things. You know, we need a better system, and there are some systems, some for free. One of them that I've used in the past is usendit.com. There's a free version, but there's also some paid-for versions depending on how big of files you want to send. But essentially it works like this. You go to usendit.com, you upload your file to it. Let's say you've got a 25-megabyte file that you want to share with somebody. So you upload that file, you enter in their email address, the person that you'd like to send it to. So the file uploads, an email goes out to the recipient notifying them that a file is available on the USendIt server for download. It's only available for 7 days with the free version, so they have to grab it right away. But you can upload up to 100 megabyte files for free. The emails go out to however many people you want to send them out to. They can all go and grab it. So now, in effect, you've created a very easy-to-use system. The emailing is automatic. The download is very easy. You just click on a link, and down it goes. If you want to send up something larger than 100 megs, you can. There's a $9.99 a month service called the Pro version, and you can upload up to a 2 gigabyte file that they can download. Now, there are some download limits on the amount of downloads that can happen, but I think for most of our uses, you know, what they provide for free is good enough. So check it out, usendit.com. They claim it's very secure. I've used it on many occasions to exchange large files, just a great service and a growing need. So usendit.com.
You know, Martin, I can really think of a good use for that. In our congregation, we do a lot of digital recording. So having MP3 files, say, of a catechism class that a student might have missed would be really powerful to be able to just shoot those files across. And those can get up to 20 meg or 30 meg if they're an hour long. Mm-hmm. So I could definitely see a use for that in congregations and schools.
Mm-hmm. Wells.net, feature of the week. Sally, what do you have for us this week?
Well, I wanted to point everyone to our church locator service. Again, with summertime in mind, and as you're planning your summer trips, I encourage you to use our church locator service, which is part of the Wells.net website. You can find it in the top toolbar that goes along for the ride on every page of Wells.net. There's a link there, or you can go to wells.locatorsearch.com to access the site directly. What you're going to find there is an easy way to put in a location, a city and state, and you can narrow your search to churches or schools or that kind of thing. But it's going to return for you all of the area congregations and schools based on the city and state that you put into the search engine. And that's wonderful, again, for vacation planning. As you're on the road, you want to make your worship a part of your vacation plan. So you'll find there's service times and maps and all the information that you need to be a part of the worship that's coming up in the area that you're going to be visiting. So I encourage you to check it out. It's at wells.locatorsearch.com.
Wonderful. So don't take a vacation from church. You've got a great tool where you can find any Wells church across the country, no matter where you're going. Wanted to remind everybody of some summer conferences coming up, at least one of them, Sally. Where is that?
This one is the Worship Conference coming up at the end of July, July 28th through 31st. And the deadline for registering is fast approaching. That's June 15th that you need to have your registration in by. You can find information on the web at wells.net/jump/worship-conf, C-O-N-F. It's going to be held at Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter, Minnesota. And boy, have they got quite the lineup at the worship conference this summer. It's one you don't want to miss. There's tracks for those that are musically inclined, keyboardists, choral directors, teachers, and for non-musicians, pastors who are doing worship planning, information on cross-cultural worship experiences, on church architecture and worship history. So there's definitely something for everyone. You won't want to miss the high school honors choir that will be part of the worship experience there, and also the special handbell choir that will be part of the worship experience. It's going to be a great conference. More online at wells.net/jump worship-conf.
Get your registrations in by June 15th. Mm-hmm. Community feedback. Anything going on the Wells Tech listserv, Sally?
Yes, there's currently a thread about teaching keyboarding skills, and I encourage you guys to go out and read up on different schools' uses of keyboarding techniques, and also contribute. You know, let's all share ideas about the best ways to teach keyboarding. If you know of software that you're using in your school, or if you have certain standards that you're asking your students to comply to, you know, maybe they all need to type at a speed of 35 words a minute or something by the time they finish eighth grade. We'd love to hear more about that on the Wells Tech listserv, and we have links to the listserv in the show notes.
Thanks, Sally. Well, Sally, Gail, that's another Wells Tech podcast episode in the books. Thanks again so much, Gail, for joining us. We really appreciate your experience in the digital education field. What was that title again? I've got to go back now. Our
semi-regular classroom
technology correspondent.
There you go. I'll have to engrave that on something.
Something very wide. All right. Thanks again, both of you, for joining us. We will talk to everybody next week. We'll close the show with our Wells featured musician. This week, the group In His Service, made up of Patricia Backus and Valerie Flater. I really enjoy their music. Beautiful, beautiful compositions. This week we will hear the song I Heard the Voice of Jesus Say from their album In His Time. Thanks everybody for listening. We really appreciate you tuning in each week, and tune in next week, and we'll talk to you again about technology and ministry.